We're talking to Guy Ames about growing fruit crops. Welcome to the Arkansas Organic Chronicles podcast, where we discuss anything, everything, and all things related to certified organic food right here in Arkansas. I'm Joe Hannum, production instructor at Calf Farm School. With me today is Guy Ames of Ames Orchard and recently retired from the National Center for Appropriate Technology. Hi, Guy. How's it going today?
Pretty good. I'm cold like you are. We're snowed in like the whole country is, pretty much.
Yes. Yeah, it's just a cold bugger outside, but nice thing about Arkansas, a couple of days, it'll be warm again, and we'll have no snow.
Probably, and then we'll have another.
Then we'll have another round, but at least it's not stacking.
Right, that's true.
Talking to my brother in Iowa, and he's got about 24 inches of snow on the ground.
I'm a weather nut, and I've been watching Maine and Iowa, and yeah, of course, the whole country's watching Iowa because politics.
Politics, but that's a whole other show.
Yeah, we don't have to get into that.
We don't. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast today. We're going to talk a little bit about growing organic tree fruit here in Arkansas and what works, what doesn't work, and just kind of the goods and bads about it. And this is episode one of a three-part episode as we dive into crops, dive into climate change, and then we'll dive into actually growing apples with another guest here in a couple weeks. So,
oh, cool. Who's that going to be?
That'll be hopefully Maury Wills from Wills Orchard up in Iowa.
Okay. All right. Good.
You probably know Maury. I'm sure you've crossed paths.
I've heard the name. That's all.
So let's get started here with our first question, Guy. From my perspective, a thriving local food system should include some fruit crops. That's a major part of our diet.
Right.
When I hear you talk, though, I always hear you talk about being cautious growing organic tree fruit here in Arkansas. And so I want to ask you a little bit about why that's the case and why do you try to steer people away from growing organic apples, cherries, and peaches here in Arkansas, especially if you're trying to sell them into a retail market.
Well, you've given the outline of the problem right there, and that's doing it commercially for a market. So the problem, of course, is climate. And the other problem is really cultural. And I mean human cultural, not agricultural. I mean cultural. And that's when we think of tree fruits, as you've already mentioned, the main ones are apples and peaches and pears and the like. And none of those are native to this continent. We do have a native crab apple here. And there's probably something like a pear, but I guess the closest thing would be the June berries. They're in that family, or a pome fruit. But basically, they're not native to this continent. And because of that, some of the diseases and pests that exist here, the trees, the fruit, I'm talking about the apples and peaches, et cetera, at this point, have had no exposure, so they haven't built up resistance, evolutionarily speaking. So I like to point out that Prunus persica, the Latin binomial for peach, gives us a little hint to that. Persica, of course, is short for Persia, and that gives us a hint of where it's from. It's not exactly from present-day Iran, but close enough, and therein lies the problem. We have got this major disease, Monolinia. Well, the pathogen is Monolinia fructicola, and the disease is brown rot of peach and plums, and we just don't have the resistance in the crop. So if you're trying to do it organically without pesticides, without synthetic pesticides, it's always going to be a chore. Now, of course, people have tried to just stand the brown rot example, use sulfur and other things that were accepted as organic. But I don't know how you feel about it, but sulfur is not as toxic as some things. But honestly, it was kind of grandfathered in the old days when we came up with the certification standards. And sulfur can be hard on soil organisms. It can be hard on spiders and beneficial mites. So it's not a totally benign organism. I mean, material, the sulfur.
It's not. We still wear a pretty solid PPE when using it.
Yeah, you should. Yeah, I mean, water and sulfur make sulfuric acid. So, So yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. And you go through all the other ones, you know, fire blight for apples and pears. That's a, I don't know how it got so big here on this continent without the apples and pears, but truly, of course, there's in nature, in the wild here, there's got to be a bunch of hosts. Could even be the wild roses and things like that, because it's all in the Rosaceae family, like the apples and pears. But when you brought these named European varieties over, especially the French and English, because those are the two cultures that we borrowed from most extensively, they're exposed to fire blight, and it was devastating, just absolutely devastating. Now, a few other diseases like that. Cedar apple rust was present in Europe, and so most of the apple varieties get, well, maybe not most. So that's the main thing, really, is that we've as our culture, as this Northern European culture came to this new land, we dragged our agricultural food stuffs with us, and they just really haven't been that adaptable here heretofore, at least to, well, and let's get back to the other part. You said commercial, at least to commercial production. Now, when you talk about the market and commercial production, there was a time in this country before Washington got into it and West Coast, everyone was used to a certain amount of cartoons. My brain is going far field here, but it'll all make sense, I hope, in the end. Cartoons, if you were going to show an apple a cartoon, it had a worm in it. And mostly that was just a comic device. But the truth is that probably a whole lot of the apples grown in colonial days, let's get back into that, you know, pre-synthetic pesticides, had a worm in it, Kalimoth or Punculio. Could have been something else too. There's the apple Kukulio and some other pests that could have left a worm in the apple. But those are the two main ones. People were used to it, and you cut around it. Oh, sooty blossoms, fly speck, of course, duh. If you go back and look at these real old books on, you know, from, oh, again, pre-modern synthetic fungicides, almost every apple, especially the yellow ones that are depicted by paintings and old photographs, have sooty blotch on them, which is a superficial fungus. I know you know, but our listeners may not know. This fungus on the apple skin looks like it sounds, sooty. It looks like you've smudged the apple surface with soot. It's a fungus. It's pretty benign. It feeds on the wax of the apple. It doesn't really do much to apple. It might impact the storability of the apple a little bit. But really, the point I'm trying to make right now is that the people before, I mean, the early colonists, the people that were growing apples before we started growing apples in the West, before modern growing techniques and transportation, things like that allowed us to base an apple industry off of just one region in the country growing them, in this case, the Pacific Northwest. Everybody was used to the sooty blotch. It was just no big deal. When you went out west and started growing apples in Washington State and you didn't have the humidity that the fungus, the sooty blotch fungus needs, you produced perfect apples. They could grow without even trying. We now have in this country now in modern times, you know, let's say starting, we'll just make it simple. It's not quite this simple, but let's say 1900. It's when Washington State came online, as far as, you know, marketing apples. And we developed very quickly a de facto market standard of cosmetically perfect apples, or nearly so. It's not as if they didn't have any pests out there, but out west, around, you know, Wenatchee, Washington being the center of it, you just don't have that kind of disease pressure, period. You just don't need to spray fungicides. And so if you do, you're usually spraying for, you know, I can't even imagine what they spray out there. My point is that if they're not growing organically out there, I want to know why. We have to try so hard back east, you know, to grow things organic.
Yes.
But here's the point, as far as the market goes, they have set the standard for us. We have a nationwide food system, marketing system. And even if you go into an organic food store, you know, Whole Foods, which is they carry organic and others, any part of the grocery store that sells organic apples, if you look closely and it's the information is available, you'll see quickly that those apples don't come from anywhere other than the Pacific Northwest. Like maybe California, I guess that's not the mostly one state. And that's because to grow them organically back here and meet the market standard that they have met up there because of their low humidity, they set it. I mean, they didn't meet it, they set it. So you don't have any of these, what would you call them? Superficial fungi, superficial imperfections like the sooty blotch and the fly speck on the apples. Don't have the more serious fungal diseases like black rot, white rot, bitter rot. I'm still speaking almost exclusively to apples right now, but it's true, just different diseases with these other crops too. So therein lies the problem here, really, with the you got culture. So we're trying to grow these apples that we brought, or the fruits that we brought with us from Northern Europe. We've got a slightly different climate here, and we have a new set of pathogens and pests. And if I haven't made the point clearly, I keep saying that they don't have the immunity out there, but let's look at the Pacific Northwest, the competition again. And what we have is irrigated desert. The area around Wenatchee probably gets 10 to 14 inches of rainfall a year. And it's dry as a bone for the most part, and you just can't, those fungi just simply do not exist out there. So then you have these big irrigation districts that are with all of our tax dollars, the Snake and the Columbia and some of those other major rivers out there, who I can think of off the top of my head, but those two for sure have been dammed up, and you've got cheap irrigation water. So you're growing apples in the irrigated high desert country. And in the high desert, there's hardly any diseases of these fruits that we're talking about. And frankly, very few of the pests. They did import, they brought in accidentally a codling moth back in the early part of the 20th century, but they just don't have a pumpkin culo at all. It doesn't even exist west of the Rocky Mountains. And that's a huge one for us. They do have a few stink bugs, but nothing like we can get going back east. So those are the problems. Cultural, you know, wanting to grow fruits that maybe aren't that well adapted here. And then our climate back east, because we're speaking here from Arkansas. And then the competition, the market standards set by a different climate and enabled by this modern food system with this refrigeration and the transportation and everything else. I've gone on a long time without asking you if you need clarification, Joe, but
I have a kind of a follow-up question here.
Good.
So we in the vegetable world, we can do a lot of breeding and breed for resistance against a lot of our disease
Yes.
organisms that we deal with here in the center eastern part of the country.
Yes.
How come we don't have that, or why do we not see that same resistance network for a lot of our tree fruit?
Well, we do in some cases. In apples, it was slow to come about, but we did start breeding for scab resistance, which is a cosmopolitan disease. That is, it exists worldwide. And they found a crab apple that had scab resistance, and they slowly, using the old conventional breeding methods, were able to introduce resistance to a whole lot of varieties. And there are some modern varieties that are highly scab resistant, almost immune, like Enterprise. And then even the new Cosmic Crisp, which is a progeny of Enterprise, has good scab resistance. So we're starting to do that. And I suspect now that we have CRISPR and all these other tools that we'll get better at that and we'll have those. I hope we do. It will sure help out a lot. But yeah, being able to use resistant varieties has been a boon. And that's what's made the little success I've had with apples, for instance, has been mostly with those varieties, those highly disease-resistant varieties, mostly as a result of breeding efforts. By the way, just to give, because I like to give credit to these heroes, to me, they're heroes, the plant breeders. They're mostly from Purdue, Rutgers, and Illinois. And those apple growers that are listening to this might recognize that a lot of these varieties I'm talking about have P, R.I., Purdue, Rutgers, Illinois, in their names, like Pristine and Priscilla and Enterprise and Surprise. Anyway, if it weren't for those folks, those breeders there at those institutions, it would be even harder. And again, I suspect in the future it'll get easier. We've had a hard time, even with modern breeding, had a hard time with fire blight resistance, incorporating fire blight resistance. We have it. It's hard to give it a commercial level of control if the particular year's weather makes it conducive to fire blight. It's, cedar apple rust is a weird one. There's a lot of resistance out there, but I don't know anyone that's breeding specifically for that. But there are quite a few varieties that are just by happenstance, just complete serendipity, are resistant to cedar apple rust. Happily, most of these PRI selections are resistant to apple rust because they screened. I'm not sure they really looked per se, you know, to incorporate the genes for resistance, but they did screen for resistance when they were thinking about releasing these varieties. So most all the ones that I mentioned, gold rush, are resistant to cedar rust too. Did I answer your question?
It did, but it also, I think, kind of misses the fact that this is a really slow process in developing resistance for fruit crops as opposed to a vegetable where we can do 2, 3, 4 generations in a year. You're looking at a generation on a test for a treat for an apple or something years down the road before
it was
you really
years
get
in
that
fact
data.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Joe, with these old techniques with conventional breeding, it was not uncommon for a professor or breeder, plant breeder, to spend their entire professional career developing a resistant variety of peach or apple or something. And they would just they would release those varieties often at the end of their careers.
Yeah.
So it's, you're exactly right. That just complicates everything. You know, you couldn't, using these old methods, you know, in a seed, you wouldn't even get a crop. You make your crosses, you identify a resistant variety, you make some crosses, you grow those seeds out, and then if you plant the trees out, you've got another 6 to 8 years from there. So yeah, it was really a multi-year thing, and it continues to be right now. Again, I think the genetic tools we have now will probably shorten that considerably. But
yeah, the genetic tools are kind of nice with being able to look for specific traits before you get the mature fruit.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I cut you off. So,
well, I'm just suspicious of. You know, I've got a conventional training. You know, I've got my master's degree from the University of Arkansas, and I believe in science, but I also believe that we can't see everything, which is where organic, even the word organic, comes in, you know, meaning whole. Science tends to, and rightly so, be reductionist. It follows, it's trying reasons for whatever phenomenon they're investigating, and there's unintended consequences. when you're breeding for this, you're also breeding for that. You may not realize it.
Yep. Yeah. So, and if you don't have it grown out, you may not see everything that you're looking for.
So I only bring that up in the CRISPR and these other genetic tools look great. They probably will be beneficial, but I suspect there'll be some unintended consequences down the line. The nature of the beast, I mean, it's unintended. We don't know what it is yet. But, you know, I'm 72 years old now. I've been around long enough, and I've seen a lot of things come and go already. And unintended consequences is something we should at least expect, even if they're not intentional.
Absolutely.
We'll see.
And you're probably not wrong. There's always something, or something will get rushed, and it'll get missed. And
yep.
Yeah. I say that all the time about Bud9 rootstock and how quickly it took off in the industry, only to find out, it actually has some pretty serious problems.
Yep. I did that. There was a rootstock that came out of Michigan State called Mark, and it was the same way. It was really, it looked good in the trials, but when you put it out, especially among organic growers, we weren't going to use any soil drenches, woolly apple aphid is a soil pest, just ravaged that thing, just almost destroyed it. So, in fact, you never hear about Mark rootstock anymore. So,
no, I think that was kind of come and gone before I even started in the industry.
Probably so.
Another follow up question. This is kind of one a little bit off the wall, but something I encountered here not too long ago. Going back and talking about scab resistance, I was out at an organic orchard where they have some trees that are in that 20, 25 year range, and they're starting to lose their scab resistance. Have you seen that before?
No, but I have read about it, and that's it runs counter to hesitate to call it dogma, but let's say it runs counter to what we thought. I mean, there it is again, unintended consequences. So in this case, it's maybe not a consequence of the breeding, but just something no one expected. It shouldn't, quote unquote, be happening. The genetic resistance should maintain. But of course, out there in nature, there's always a battle going on between pest and host, disease and host. And any resistance, this is a little easier to see with vegetable crops or any annual crop, grains and stuff. The pests and diseases that rely on that host are going to always be working, quote unquote, you know, they're really just evolving.
Yeah.
To overcome whatever resistance, whatever the nature of that resistance is. That reminds me of another huge difference between perennials and annuals, Joe, and that's rotations. We can't rotate out of a problem if we're doing tree fruit. I mean, you could. But
you really can't. I mean, especially with so many of these orchards so limited on space already.
Yeah. Yeah. Space. If you're trying to rotate, you realize that you've got a serious problem with, say, Phytophthora root rot on cherries or something. And if you decide you want to rotate out, well, the establishment costs, let's just get completely practical here. The establishment costs of any kind of orchard is really high. And to decide, oh, this is not going to work, and to change crops or varieties after a couple of years, it's pretty much prohibitive, economically speaking. It's not an easy thing to do. So as rotation as a tool is, you can rotate the cover crops, and you can top work apple trees, and you can graft over older trees. That saves a couple of years. But basically, I think it's, as a practical matter, we can say we don't have rotation as a tool for a serious pest. It's just not available.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. So, Guy, do you mind if we change gears a little bit and talk about some of the fruit crops? And this doesn't have to be just tree fruit, but some of the fruit crops that you do suggest people grow in Arkansas, and then maybe you can highlight whether it's something that just should grow at home, or maybe or whether it have some commercial suitability.
Yeah.
I'm going to take the blackberries off the list there, because that's the easy one.
Oh, darn!
Sorry.
Yeah, but yeah, you mentioned blackberries, so you know any of those fruits, those cane fruits, bush fruits that are going to bear quickly are tend to be easier. A lot of those too have, raspberries have, even though the ones, the commercial raspberry came from Europe, but you know, there are native raspberries. And of course, the blackberry is a native North American fruit. So we've got that going for us. Blueberries are really interesting. I just updated ATRA's blueberry publication, and I wanted to make clear to people that one of the reasons that blueberries are so often a failure has nothing to do with whether or not they're organically grown, or it has virtually nothing to do with that. It's just a failure to understand the nature of the plant. And blueberries, like cranberries, a close relative, are really a swamp plant or a bog plant. And so you need to somehow accommodate the features of a bog plant. For instance, and this is the big one, as root hairs. Blueberries have no root hairs because they didn't need them. They never evolved them. They didn't need them in the swamp, so they never evolved them. And if you get ATRA.org, you can go there and get the new blueberry publication.
Yeah, I'll put a link to it in the show notes here.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
You just have to make sure that you've got good drainage, because even though it was a swamp plant, there's still some diseases in stagnant water and slow-moving water, still root diseases that the blueberry is susceptible to. But mostly, it needs to somehow accommodate those features that evolved as a swamp plant. So it needs regular moving water. You've pretty much got to have drip irrigation. You know, as a home gardener, and you think you're going to grow these, you might know this, and you hear people say you've got to water these regularly. Well, you may not realize how regularly until you go on that 3 week vacation and come back, and in August or July, and your blueberries are toast. Or this is very common, after you've harvested, June at the latest, and then you go, well, okay. Fruit crop is done. I'll let these things rest until next year. You got to keep watering them. If there's a drought in the winter, you got to water them. Not common, but it happens too.
It does happen. I've watered mine in the winter before.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, so blueberries are really a good one, and commercially, you can do blueberries organically, which is really something. And they're easy to sell. They're easy to market. The biggest, I know, I just learned this when I was doing this publication, Joe. The biggest blueberry producer in the country is Washington State now. Dang
I
it
did not know that. I'm shocked why they
again.
would be growing
Me
them
too.
there.
Yeah, me too. I think they have well-drained soils, which is a necessity, and I think they have available water. Again, those big irrigation districts, you know, based on the Snake and the Columbia and all those other big rivers out there. That's my guess. I don't really know. I know they don't have acid soils, or
Right, but if you're
it's not a
watering
given.
every day or every other day, you can deal with that.
Yes, right. That's right. That's not a big deal. Anyway, when we talk about some of the fruits that we can grow here without pesticides, and this one commercially, blueberries are really up near the top. As long as you keep those, you know, specifics in mind, you got to keep that soil pH low. And if you're back east here where you have a lot of rainfall, it's going to tend to gradually creep back up. Not because the rainfall is making the soil pH go up. It's just because it's washing out the sulfur that you had to use to lower it in the first place. So you're going to have to monitor that soil pH. And I would suggest, if you're doing it commercially, I wouldn't suggest, I would mandate that you grow those things with trickle irrigation. So blueberries would be one. And there's, again, that's a native crop, and the marketing's already done. You know, the blueberries in my lifetime, it was really a new crop to this country too. And some of these other crops we're going to talk about aren't, but because blueberries are already here, the marketing's already been done. People already like blueberries. They're amenable to organic culture. As long as you get the irrigation, just know you're going to have to. Probably you want to use raised beds too to make sure that your soil drainage is good and that water to them, and you can grow commercial blueberries and do well. You can do
That's
well.
the other nice thing about blueberries and blackberries. There's a ton of information on how to actually grow them. So there should be
Yes.
no like hidden secrets or anything like that.
Ah, that's a very good point. Yeah, the whole information thing. I tend to forget that because I live, you know, in this ocean of information with at ATRA, at that old Sustainable Ag Information Service I just retired from, is just awash with information. So yes, that's a very important thing. Some of these other crops we're going to talk about is not as much information available because they're just either been domesticated, like a Juneberry. It's hard to say it's really been domesticated, but introduced to the larger culture. And of course, pawpaws. Those are a couple of big ones. Jujubes are, I think they're coming down the pike. I think they have commercial potential too. Which one would you like me to focus on next?
Let's start with pawpaws.
Okay. Oh yeah, pawpaws. Wow, what an amazing fruit. So, and I love this. You know, they try to grow them out west, but it's hard. And Oregon State had a trial some years back, and I'm not sure they ever figured it out. They had a NC-140 planting. Anyway, they had a planting out there that was being coordinated nationwide. There was all these different universities, institutions that were all going to plant the, I don't even remember how many, 60 to 100, you know, pawpaw plants and different varieties. They had one here too. They did it here. Got pushed out in favor of golf turf, I think, but which really makes me see red. But they can't grow them out west. My point is that for once we have an advantage. It's very difficult to grow pawpaws out west. I'm not sure anybody knows all the reasons, but probably a little bit would do with soil pH. Their love need soil organic matter. I suspect that mycorrhizae is a big part of their needs or cultural needs. You know, it's a big fruit. It's very tasty, although there is a flavor component to the acetogenins that are important to the flavor of the pawpaw, impart some of the tropical essence of the pawpaw, also impart some off flavors to a lot of people. There's some pawpaws I just don't like. I haven't found one right here from the Ozarks yet that I'm crazy about, but Kentucky State University is doing research on this, and they're trying to breed out some of those, or select for, I don't know how much breeding they're doing, but at least select for lower levels of the acetogenins, and give us a better flavor pawpaw, or consistently better flavor. Because the truth is that a good pawpaw is, it's luscious, it's wonderful, it's an epiphany for a lot of people to have a really good pawpaw grown here, because it's essentially a tropical fruit. And if you see the tree, the pawpaw tree, it's immediately recognizable as a tropical fruit. And then, if you start to explore the botany, you'll find that the Vandenaceae, that it's a member of the family, the botanical family that it's part of, the pawpaw is just practically the only, well, commercially important, certainly, but there's hardly any other Vandenaceous crops, period, that grow in temperate zones. They're all tropical. So, what we have really is a tropical fruit that we can grow all the way up into New York State. They grow some in Ontario. The big problem with pawpaws is perishability. They're not really truly ripe until they are fallen from the tree, and they're soft and very easily bruised. So it's hard for me at this point to imagine a pawpaw, fresh pawpaw industry developing in any big way. But to my way of thinking, that's good. That's a good thing. It just means that you're going to have to develop a local market, a market that will accept a little bit of bruising and damage because they understand it. They know the grower. I don't know. I love pawpaws. It's one of the few crops that we grow that we pretty consistently make money off of. It's a challenge when they start ripening. We've got to move fast, so we have to stay on it. But it's fun. People love them. When I take them to the farmers market, there's usually a line, and I can sell them out as fast as I can bag them up.
So, what's the harvest window on a on the pawpaw season?
Well, do you mean
Couple days,
the
couple
whole
weeks.
season? Do you mean the whole season, or do you mean a fruit?
Yeah, just for harvesting the fruit.
Okay, so you'd start in late August, and you might get in as far as mid-September. One thing about pawpaws, and it goes along with what I already said, you have to, if you're going to do this commercially at all, more than just a couple of trees, you've got to have refrigeration. So if you're going to do it, you know, bigger than what your refrigerator could hold, you're going to have a walk-in cooler or something like that. When I say from August to mid-September, I'm talking about different varieties, because there's no one variety that might start in August isn't going to go, you know, just for a couple of weeks, maybe three at the most, before it's exhausted. That tree has exhausted its fruit, and then you're going to have another variety that starts maturing the fruit a little bit later, et cetera, et cetera. So
So,
you have to have multiple varieties or seedlings, and you're going to have refrigeration. And the season's going to be short, but it's going to be frantic.
can you get upwards of 5, 6 weeks from for a harvest season with Papa, or is that a little bit too long?
No, you can. You
Okay.
can. But again, it's going to have to be different varieties. So, yeah. And you'll still have to have the refrigeration. You can hold a pawpaw in pretty good shape for a week, on the outside 2 weeks if you have an understanding clientele. But yeah, 5 6 weeks is going to be the max, and that could be good. You don't want to work year round like I do.
It's the nice thing for somebody that wants to do something on the side, right? You have a short season of harvest that you got to be at market and could still have your regular day job.
There's another thing I like about pawpaws. I look sometimes enviously at the commodity growers, the big soybean and grain, corn, wheat, and they take the winters off. They can go to the Barbados if they want to. I'm out here pruning and sometimes grafting and doing 100 other little chores related to the fact that these are perennial fruits. And they exist in the ground year round. And the pruning, especially. Well, pawpaws, some of that's true, but and they might benefit from pruning, but right now nobody's saying that pruning is a must. We get good yields without pruning. In other words, we don't prune pawpaws. We prune out some low limbs and some damaged limbs, but that's about all.
Do you do any thinning for fruit size management?
I think they're just starting those research trials too at Kentucky State.
Okay.
But what little I know, what little I've done myself, it doesn't seem to make much difference.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is, because I can say that I've had just by happenstance or by late frosts and stuff,
Yeah.
I've had large crops and small crops. The trees that produce large fruit continue to produce large fruit, regardless of crops. Size, pretty much. I mean, there's a slight effect I can see, but those that tend to produce small fruit still produce small fruit even with a smaller crop, and that certainly wouldn't be true of apples or pears. So the pawpaws are very different that way too. Yeah, I think the only other thing to say about pawpaws is that the fact that they are Native American. I don't know. There's still a romance about pawpaws right now. I don't know if it'll last. I'd like to think it will, but we're still learning to understand that the Native Americans used them, that the pioneers did, the slaves did. There's a kind of history and romance of pawpaws that's just being tapped. I think that this one is gonna last for a while. The pawpaw fever that seems to grip some parts of the country. There are one of the ways people get around perishability problem is to have pawpaw festivals, have a big party when during pawpaw harvest, and there's big ones in Ohio is the biggest and the oldest, but they're in Ohio and West Virginia, Maryland. I'd like to start one myself and may do so pretty soon,
Okay.
but I think we can be through with pawpaws. What else we got?
What did you have next? June,
Oh, elderberries, which is it's a fruit crop, but a little different.
Yeah, we can talk about elderberry. I know
Yeah.
there's a fair bit of elderberry interest, especially as you push up into Missouri and things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, one of the really interesting things about elderberries, well, lots of things, but it's one of those unintended consequences. So I'm going to start with a little bit of the negative, because for the longest time, and you'll still see it in print a lot, people will say, well, there's a carefree fruit. Well, here you go again. You try to do something commercially, and there's an unintended consequence. If you grow a bunch of elderberries together, you're asking for a disease or an insect problem sooner or later. And I did.
That's
So,
anytime you put any crop into a whole bunch together at once.
And here you go with the perennials again. The perennials are real hard to change. They were never meant to be, if you look at evolutionary or natural systems, they were never meant to be all jammed together. But if you're a commercial grower, for the ease of harvest and marketing and stuff, you grow them together. Elderberry right next to elderberry, elderberry. Well, I got elderberry sawfly, and that's a pest. If I'd bothered to look, it's in there. It's in the literature. You can find that it's a potential pest. But I mean, Joe, I looked out at my elderberry. It was in springtime before they really started. I guess they were flowering, I think. Yeah, they already had flowers on them, I remember now. But one day I looked at them, and they looked beautiful and everything was going great. And maybe a week later, my eye kind of passed over that part of my field. And what the heck? That looks funny. I walked over there. They were defoliated.
Oh no.
This little elderberry sawfly had just stripped them. It was incredible. And I had it again the next year and thought that, that some kind of balance would restore itself without my effort. And it just didn't happen that way. I had to get in there and spray some spinosad just try to bring it back into some kind
Oh,
of balance,
goodness.
at least balance from my perspective. So anyway, that's a negative. I haven't heard any other growers really have a serious problem with elderberry sawfly, but there is an aerified mite. It's a serious problem on elderberries sometimes. It really crinkles the leaves up and it's going to affect the photosynthesis. But for the most part, elderberries are really easy to grow. There's a pretty good market for elderberry products. There's very little fresh eating, of course. They make pretty good pies. I've only had one pie made from elderberries, but it was really good. Great wine. And of course, all the health benefits are pretty well established. I don't think there's any serious debate anymore about the benefits, the health benefits. I went to the world, what do they call it, International Elderberry Conference up in Colombia a few years back, and it was international. Of course, there is a European elderberry species too, but anyway, there were doctors, medical researchers from Israel and Europe and United States, and all kinds of growers. But anyway, it's still a hot crop as far as I know, and there's a you know it's one of those things that the big boys could it could parts of it could be mechanized, but there's probably always a place for some small elderberry production locally.
So what's the harvest season on elderberry?
Oh gosh, I'm always surprised. There's usually some early ones, but I use August just like everything else. A little bit earlier, I think you could. One of the things the commercial growers are doing these days is just mowing them. If you can maintain fertility, it's not that hard to do. You can do it with manures, composts. You can just mow those things down, and they'll come back and bear on first year wood on current season growth. So you can really
Oh, that really takes
simplify.
management down to super, super simple.
Yeah, it really would. It means that you're going to be harvesting all at once, which for most farmers that's an advantage. But if you had a smaller market, you might want to spread it out and you develop your market and then you have later crops to sell. So if you do that, of course, you're going to tend to what's the word? Focus your harvest to if you mow down in the spring or winter, the subsequent crop is going to ripen pretty much at the same time. Probably an advantage, but anyway, that's just something that's pretty cool, I think. Probably something I haven't done it really. I have chopped some plants back, and even sometimes when we're propagating elderberries, we can put the little elderberry stick in the ground. That stick will develop into a reasonable sized plant and have fruit the very same year.
Oh boy, that's crazy.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, really remarkable. By the way, just harking back to pawpaws just for a second. It can take pretty commonly 5 to 6 years to get a pawpaw plant into production. So you better have some elderberries on the side. What
Yeah,
else?
that's crazy. You can turn around and produce in that same year or the following year on new woody tissue. That's not common in the fruit crop world.
No, it is not. It's a real oddball fruit, anyway.
So, all
Anywho.
right, well, there's several good fruits that we can grow here in Arkansas. Any other
Well,
ones that you really like that maybe are not quite to the commercial use stage?
that just barely because they are commercial, but grapes and especially muscadines. Now I'm a little worried about this cold snap we're experiencing right now that I might lose my muscadines again. But officially, we can't grow muscadines up here in the northwest corner of Arkansas. But only lost one crop over the years, and that was from that February of 21, that freeze, and it really hammered our vines, and so we lost that subsequent crop that year. But they do come back, and then you have a crop pretty quickly the way grapes grow. Muscadines are fantastic, of course. They yield like crazy. People love them. You can make all kinds of other products out of them, wine and preserves and jellies and things. So, and muscadines especially have very few disease and pest problems. The Japanese beetle is a little bit of a problem on bunch grapes, but not nearly so much on muscadines. Black rot, which is the scourge of seedless grapes, not a problem on muscadines. So, for an organic grower, they even grow organic muscadines in Florida, for God's sake.
Oof.
Yes, that's right. Woo, you understand. So, you listeners that don't understand the ecology of fruit production. Florida's a jungle. You understand that? It's a jungle. The heat and humidity is murderous. But you can grow muscadines organically and commercially, and they do. So one of the ways you can make a little bit of money on muscadines is to grow them outside, and we have in the past grow them outside of their conventional range. They're a well known and accepted crop in Mississippi and Louisiana and places like that. They're not so well known here, but people that know them, that we can sell every muscadine that we can pull off the vine. So the only other thing I can think is negative about muscadines and bunch grapes in general is to trellis them, and for some people that's an impediment. For organic growers, you're going to have to use cedar posts or metal posts. So I don't consider that a serious impediment, but that's a lot of people do apparently.
That's that wintertime work for you.
I love jujubes. They're not native. Almost everything else we've been discussing, if we don't include the apples and pears we talked about first, have been natives of blueberries, the pawpaws, the elderberries, they're all native. Muscadines too. But the jujubes aren't. They're from I think Southwest China, but boy, they really do well here. And I think the biggest problem with the jujubes is just developing a market. You've got to convince a clientele that these are or but I took them to farmers market and had no problem, absolutely no problem selling them. We're still experimenting with preserving them, but I can't think of a plant out there in my little orchard that is free at this point anyway than jujubes. I better knock on wood, huh?
Yeah, you better.
I do want to mention the bunch grapes. Still have time?
Yeah, I was gonna ask, wanted to go back and ask a little bit about bunch grapes, specifically like the seedless table ones, Mars and Jupiter and things, but we'll see where you were gonna go there.
You may know, because Luke Freeman from the university, and he worked on the bunch grapes under glass, so to speak, undercover, with high tunnels,
I
hoop
didn't
house.
realize he worked with the high tunnel grapes.
Yeah, oh yeah,
All
yes, he
right,
did.
yeah, I'll have to pick his brain more then.
In fact, I think his master's work was with organic fertilization in high tunnels, which is a little bit tricky because of the salts build up in the soil. But anyway, the seedless, I have yet to find a seedless grape that I can grow organically. Mars is close. Mars has resistance to the multitude of grape diseases, except for black rot. And black rot will just wipe it out completely. So you have to do something for black rot. If you time your sprays right, and they're much earlier than you think, folks. But if you time your sprays right, you can control it with sulfur. So Mars is a great seedling. Now, what I won't really want to say about bunch grapes, though, is to mention the Munson grapes, these old grapes that came from the late 18, early, and the latest Smithsonian, Joe, has an article about these Munson grapes. I thought, and they're fantastic. I love them, but they're all seeded, and the average American consumer just will not accept that as a table grape. Of course, as a wine grape, they're fine, and part of this Smithsonian article was about a Kansas City grower, or up near that area, growing them for wine, and there's some incredible flavor. I just love these Munson grapes, and there's about 12 to 15 varieties that I can grow without any fungicides whatsoever. And I can't find a single modern grape variety that you can do that with. So I want to give people hope out there. If you've tried to grow grapes organically in your garden, or certainly commercially, immediately that black rot is going to keep you from doing that. But there's a multitude of other diseases. Go back and look at these Munson grapes. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. In fact, I'd go so far to say, Joe, right now they're providing me the most fun. I just love the beauty of the grapevine itself and the ripening fruit. My gosh, they're just fun. Great, give me a lot of satisfaction.
How's the vigor and cold hardiness on the Munsons?
They're very good. There's a lot of difference in the vigor. Champanelle, which is a big grape and has a little bit of history because of the Munson helping to save the French wine industry from a pest we sent that way. Yeah, for a change. It's not a great grape, but it produces like crazy. And the biggest problem with this is vigorous. And there's some that we've had that are low vigor. You figure that out pretty quickly and don't. And that's, I should mention this to the non-initiate, well, rather the initiates, the people that are just getting into grapes have to be pruned hard. And one of the reasons I'm late to coming to grapes in my professional career is I just refuse to believe it. It just doesn't seem right to follow the directions that you'll find in the books, in which you're told to remove something like 90, 95% of the wood.
That's what I was going to say. You're pruning off 90% of the last year's growth.
Yeah, it just seems wrong. And you'd think, well, I'm going to have to compensate with fertilizer. No, you don't.
Ooh, please
You do
don't.
not. And you better not, actually. They hardly need any fertilizer. In fact, the only ones I fertilize are the ones that do show the low vigor. But I love these Munson grapes. They're all seeded. So unless you're ready to get into wine, or do a little, they may not be for the commercial grower, but they might be. I can produce some beautiful clusters of some of these Munson grapes. So I'm going to try to harvest them. I mean, I'm going to try to market them next year to Ozark Natural Foods, and we'll see how that goes. But
Good one for home use.
yeah,
Maybe not
definitely
for
for home
commercial
use.
use, but definitely for processing too.
Yes, absolutely.
Wonderful. Yeah, coming from Iowa, you're talking about grape growth and things. I used to say the only thing that could grow faster than corn was grapes.
Oh yeah. There is a good one from Minnesota that I can grow organically, and it's called Edelweiss. It's a white grape. It ripens very early in the
Yeah, I was going to
season.
say it ripened in August for us.
Yes, early August, even here. Yeah, early August. So yeah, it's a great one.
That
And
is a great one. Awesome flavor, big berries.
but seeds.
Yes.
I want to chastise anybody out there that's listening that doesn't want a seeded grape. This is natural. I'm not going to get into this natural unnatural stuff, but a seedless grape isn't natural. And the other thing about seeds, a lot of these fruit crops have pawpaws. Oh my gosh, they're the worst. They have toxins in the seed because the nature, you don't want the seed eaten. That's going to be the propagule that leads to future pawpaws or apples or anything else. So in a lot of seeds, there's toxins of some sort or another. Apples, everybody seems to know that there's a, what am I trying to think of? Cyanide, cyanogenic acid in apple seeds. Anyway, grape seeds are unabashedly good for you, period. So figure out some way to use those grape seeds. I use grape seed oil in for my cooking. Anyway, grape seeds are good for you. I just want to throw that in there because I get ticked sometimes that we have these wonderful grapes, these Munson grapes that I can grow organically, and people are too lazy to spit the seeds out.
I'll be
So
honest, with Edelweiss, I don't even spit them out. I just eat them.
there you go.
They're
There
so
you go.
small anyway.
That's the easiest answer right there. Just eat them.
Right.
Good for you.
All right, guy. I think that's probably a good place to stop here today, if you're okay with that.
Oh, absolutely.
So
Sure.
I really want to just take a moment to say thanks for coming on the show here today and talking about culturally and climate-wise, and why we don't grow a lot of fruits here, but then taking some time to really talk about what we can grow here
Yeah.
in Arkansas. So appreciate it.
Bet.
All right, and then if all goes well, I'm going to try to get you on the show again here relatively soon to talk a little bit about climate change and its impact on our ability to grow fruit crops here.
Ugh. Okay.
Yes, ugh, but I think it's something that we're both passionate about, so.
Well, no, yeah. Oh boy, man, that is a kick to the gut. All
Yeah,
right.
that one is. So,
Stay warm, Joe.
all right, hold on. I'm gonna stop recording here.
Okay.
Actually, before we go today, guys, is there anything last any last words you want to say before we wrap up? I'm gonna
Well,
try
even
that
though
again.
I'm retired, I would really suggest that people go to the ATRA site. It's ATRA.org, and look at the. I've spent my most of my professional career putting together publications on how to grow fruit early. And in some cases, like the apples and the peaches, I'm a little pessimistic for commercial scale organic growers, but that ATRA library is just rich with stuff, not just my fruit stuff, but it's a good place to go for information on organic production of just about any crop.
Great, thanks. I'll make sure I get a link to that one plus specifics on some blueberries and is there elderberry, pawpaw, grape materials all there?
Yeah, it's all in there.
Perfect.
One
I'll link directly to
under
some of that
one,
stuff.
yeah, title or another, yeah.
Perfect. So, all right. Well, thanks again here.
Yep.
Much appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
All right. Take care, guy.
Bye.
This podcast was supported in part by the USDA Ag Marketing Service Transition to Organic Partnership Program and the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture. Thanks for listening, everyone.